and Mormon self-image.
Theologians have tried to explain this, scholars in religious studies have tried to explain the existence and tenacity of violence as it plays out in our religion and culture. When we're talking about a subject that is this large, I think we're all struggling to a certain extent to try to figure out what's important about understanding violence. Why is it part of our world? It seems to be part of the human experience, regardless of whether it personally touches you or whether it's part of how you navigate in the world at large. Whether we come into contact with violence at home or in the workplace, in our travels, at school, or whether we're touched by episodes of violence next door or on the other side of the planet, experiencing violence on some level is a fundamental part of being human. Various theorists claim that violence is perhaps the defining element of social, religious, and cultural development. And one religious studies scholar says that violence must be accounted for if we are to understand humanity. If we are to fully understand our experience of being human, we can't leave violence out of the equation. We all experience violence to some degree, therefore we find the need to examine its presence and role in order to understand it as part of our human experience. Violent conflicts have always been a part of human history. There's one scholar, Conrad Lorenz, whose work focuses on aggressive behavior in the animal and human world. And he says that with humanity in its present cultural and technological situation, we have good reason to consider that violence within our species is the greatest of all dangers. And again, I think we're far more aware of how true that is, how dangerous humans can be to one another. Violence has also played a significant role in American history. There was an encyclopedia entitled Violence in America that was reviewed in the Los Angeles Times in January. It's a three-volume, nearly 2,000-page work that covers topics such as gun violence, assassinations, riots, extreme sports, war, genocide, racial violence, hate crimes, serial killers, rape, spouse, partner, and child abuse, gay bashing, and gang violence, to name only a few entries. And the headline for this review suggested that violence was as American as apple pie. And I think we'd be hard-pressed to find any significant stretch of our nation's history that wasn't touched by some form of violence. Likewise, violence has also played a significant role in the Mormon experience. It's been part of church history, part of scriptures, particularly the wars and events described in the Book of Mormon, and it's certainly a part of the Mormon experience today. As I was doing research for this presentation, one of the questions I was trying to ask and answer was, do Mormons react differently to violence than their contemporaries who belong to other faiths? And is there a distinctively Mormon understanding of violence based on our collective history? And for the most part, I saw Mormons reacting to the events of September 11th much the same way as people around the country did. We mourned the loss of loved ones and strangers alike. We donated to relief efforts. We sought comfort in our communities of faith. And we forged ahead with our lives in a much more uncertain and hostile world. These similarities notwithstanding, there is some evidence that Mormons are wired a little differently when it comes to confronting violence. And in order to understand these differences, we'll need to look a little closer at how Mormons view violence, both in the past and present, and how Mormons view themselves in relationship to violence. So in order to get a more complete picture of the Mormon view on violence, we'll need to take a look at Mormon history. Time, of course, does not permit an extensive retelling of violence in early church history when it was most pervasive. I will mention a few well-known events to kind of contextualize the environment in which Mormon self-image began to crystallize and how Mormons' understanding of violence may have begun to develop. And with that foundation in place, I will address how violent events in Mormon church history shape contemporary Mormons' attitudes about violence. And last, I will take a closer look at Mormons' responses to the events of September 11th in an attempt to answer the questions I posed earlier. Is there a distinctively Mormon response to violence? So, violence in Mormon church history. It would be really easy to say that violence has played a central role in Mormonism since its beginnings in 1830. Religious leaders of the time were verbally abusive toward Joseph Smith and his claims of visions, angels, and gold plates. Mormons either fled or were kicked out of settlements in New York, Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri before packing up and moving west. In various incidents, church and personal property were vandalized. People's homes were damaged, their crops and livelihoods destroyed. Men, especially church leaders, were attacked, beaten, and subjected to the indignity of being painted with tar and covered with feathers. Women and children were threatened, physically assaulted, or chased out of their homes. In one notable example, a militia of over 200 men killed 17 Mormons and wounded 13 others at Hans Mill in Missouri. The practice of polygamy didn't do much to ease tensions between Mormons and their fellow Americans. The very notion of polygamy was repugnant to the Victorian moral standards of 19th century America, and neither the rumors about nor the practice of polygamy won over the Mormons' hostile neighbors. Other religious people thought the modern practice of polygamy was nothing short of barbaric, and critics were vocal in their condemnation of Mormons for these practices. Outsiders actually considered Mormons dangerous in their beliefs, in their practices, and in their ever-growing numbers and political clout, which in turn escalated anti-Mormon violence. Perhaps the defining act of violence in Mormon history occurred in June 1844, when the church's president and prophet Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram were murdered. While the Smith brothers and several other church leaders were incarcerated, an armed mob stormed Carthage Jail, where they were being kept, and shot and killed Joseph and Hiram. Some may have imagined that killing Joseph Smith would spell the end of Mormonism, but rather than fragmenting the Mormon community, the death of these Mormon leaders actually did more to unify the mourning church members than anything else, a unity that actually sustained them in their trek west and in their search for a less hostile community. Obviously, again, this isn't an extensive retelling, but this gives you a flavor of the kinds of events that we're talking about in early church history, the violence that shaped our collective history from the beginning. And these stories give us a foundation to discuss how these events in history shape the Mormon self-image with regard to violence. Mark Coltco Rivera is a psychologist who's analyzed elements of Mormon psychohistory, and he wrote an article that was published in Dialogue, I can't remember how long ago. And he describes the Mormon past, present, and future in terms of psychological development. And in the article, he describes the lingering effects of violence in Mormon history like this. He says, "It is clear that major violent persecutions of Mormons occurred in the 19th century, persecutions in which many individuals were murdered or forced into life-threatening circumstances to escape terrorism and murder. The Mormon mind has been powerfully shaped by Hans Mill and other massacres, the Missouri Extermination Order, Carthage Jail, the ordeal at Winter Quarters, and the shallow graves left on the exodus to the Salt Lake Valley." And if you've spent much time in the church at all, you're probably familiar with some of these stories. And as a result, to me, this seems to indicate that there's a specifically Mormon mindset, you know, maybe a collective unconscious, if you will, when it comes to the violence and trauma suffered during early church history. And this mindset and this awareness of these violent events continues to shape how Mormons look at and communicate their understanding of violence today. The persecution directed at early Mormons not only affected the people who directly experienced this violence, it also has influenced subsequent generations of Mormons. the telling and retelling of stories describing Mormon persecution, the actions of anti-Mormon individuals and groups, and the hardships the Mormons suffered makes the experience of violence very real for contemporary Mormons. I'm sure if I ask any of you, you could probably have cited the same examples that I did from church history and come up with, you know, a handful more at least. And I think since we are so familiar with these stories from Mormon history, that in turn informs our view of violence today. It is important to note that these stories of violence in church history are not relegated to the distant or forgotten past. They're included in today's church curriculum materials. They're part of Sunday school classes, primary talks, church talks, missionary discussions, and Mormonism's one religious holiday, Pioneer Day, on July 24th. And for those whose ancestors were members of the early church, family and church history are virtually indistinguishable, and the violence directed at long-dead ancestors becomes that much more personal. So how did early Mormons see themselves in relationship to violence? Although they certainly contributed to the tensions with their neighbors, Mormons seem to have a tendency to see themselves as being without sin. Innocent of wrongdoing themselves, they were merely suffering the unjust persecutions others heaped upon them. They saw themselves as victims and martyrs, but rarely did Mormons acknowledge how their attitudes, their invasion of established communities in the Midwest, or their transgression of cultural marriage norms may have provoked some of the intense negative sentiment and eventually violence directed against them. In addition to their radical theology and non-traditional form of marriage, early Mormons also earned the ire of their neighbors by being opposed to slavery, being friendly to Indians, and for upsetting the communities that they moved into. They were seen as an economic threat because they were fiercely loyal in patronizing their own shopkeepers and service providers rather than the established local merchants. They often bought vast quantities of land when they arrived at a new location, which would price the local residents out of the market. And Mormons also tended to vote as a block, giving them substantial political weight in communities that they were new to, which would also tend to alienate the longtime residents. And polygamy and claims to modern prophecy were by no means Mormons' only offenses. There was a lot that they were involved in that didn't exactly win friends and influence people. In today's interpretation of history, we also overlook how early Mormons were sometimes complicit in creating this hostile environment. As well-versed as contemporary Mormons are in retelling these stories of victimization, we have similar blind spots. We tend to be less adept at putting these events into a larger historical context. It's easier to think that early Mormons were innocent victims of violence than it is to admit that they may have been, you know, a really big part of the problem too. Mormon self-image propagates itself in the retelling of anti-Mormon persecution stories, and this has another effect on the Mormon psyche. Again, Mark Colco Rivera says this: due to the crisis of prolonged persecution, Mormonism has adopted a siege mentality, like settlers with the wagons in a circle. The circumstances demand that people adopt a herd mentality that stresses conformity above all else. To think otherwise is to separate us and become one of them. Such an approach was perhaps necessary for the survival of the church in an earlier age. It is easy to see, however, that this is still essentially the attitude taken by many church members and leaders. While Colco Rivera notes that while polygamy persecutions are long behind us, the mindset is not. He says the early persecution helped to form the worldviews of many of the leading ecclesiastical authorities of our lifetime. However, the persistence of this worldview into our own day has created some serious problems for our people. And in my own observations, I would tend to agree that Mormons haven't seemed to distance themselves much from the siege mentality, even though it's been quite some time since Mormons were in significant physical peril from their detractors. Mormons today are not under siege, Mormons as a group are not being physically assaulted or killed for their beliefs today, as far as I can tell. At worst, we may be the butt of a few polygamy jokes or endure some unfavorable press coverage. But we simply do not experience the sustained threat to life and limb that the early Mormons did. And I think perhaps it's time we came out of the bunkers and perhaps adopted a little bit more healthy attitude toward the people around us. A residual effect of this siege mentality is a kind of persecution complex. I think based on the past treatment of Mormons, today's Mormons almost seem to anticipate mistreatment from their non-Mormon peers. Mormons can be sensitive, perhaps overly so, to criticism, either real or perceived, from people outside the church. Mormons seem quick to interpret anything less than positive said about the church as actual persecution, not simply as bad press or an individual author's bias. I have a personal example of this persecution complex in action. My advisor told me to extensively rewrite my master's thesis after I'd finished the first draft. And, you know, the first draft was so dear to my heart that this was, you know, I cried in a bathroom at the School of Theology for like an hour afterwards. When I told family and friends at church about this turn of events, their initial assumption was not that my thesis needed work, which it did, but rather people seemed to leap to the conclusion that my advisor had to be anti-Mormon to make this kind of request. And it was astonishing to me that so many independent people leaped to that same conclusion. It seemed indicative to me of this mindset that anything negative said about a Mormon's writing or the LDS church was indeed persecution, and it was seen that way. For some early Mormons, persecution simply came with the territory. Historians Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitton said it was all part of the persecution that, whatever the excuses may be offered, would always be the lot of the saints of God. The Mormons could also regard persecution as a blessing in disguise, a perception that helped them in dealing with the psychological trauma of the events that they experienced. Even in the worst of circumstances, Mormons seemed to be able to wrest something positive from their sufferings. Church leaders such as Brigham Young said that good came out of persecutions and considered them a type of refiner's fire for the early saints. Leonard Arrington indicates, this sense of persecution as both fate and test of the chosen people had developed fairly early in the church. Another force, the longing for uniqueness, seems to be part of the Mormon mindset as well. Mormons are told to be in the world, not of the world, or if you were at last night's session, to be in the entertainment industry, but not of the entertainment industry. And to have some distance there. Mormons seem to take pride in referring to themselves as peculiar people without realizing this was a popular term used by many 19th century religious groups to distinguish believers from unbelievers. Granted, Mormons do have quite a few unique theological concepts, so many, in fact, that some groups don't consider us Christian at all. But you throw in angels, gold plates, proxy baptisms for the dead, polygamy, and funny underwear, we can sound a little out there. It's just how it is. So, one of my friends just said, "You Mormons are weird!" Like, well, you know, when she lists the same things that I do, I kind of have to say, "I see your point." At times, this Mormon sense of uniqueness can be accompanied by an attitude one colleague refers to as chosen people syndrome, wherein Mormons consider themselves inherently more blessed, more special, more correct, more protected, more righteous, and more worthy of God's favor than anyone else. And the same also at times seem intent on making everyone else around them aware of this chosen status. Again, this isn't an exhaustive catalog of all the elements of Mormon self-image, But this gives us a jumping off point for the next area I'd like to discuss, and that's how Mormons responded to the events of September 11th. Again, like I said, Mormons didn't react all that differently from the way everyone else reacted, with disbelief, shock, grief, and fear and anger to the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. However, some Mormons responded in a more unique fashion to the tragedies by circulating reports on the internet shortly after the attacks, saying that no Mormons and no Mormon missionaries were killed in these events. And I'm on several Mormon-related discussion lists, and these emails showed up on a couple of those lists. And there was an article in the Deseret News published September 12th indicating that no New York church members or missionaries had perished in the tragedy, which was later proven untrue. I don't know that the Des News ever ran a retraction on that. Later events indicated that a number of Mormons had been killed in these events, either in the air or on the ground. From the tone of these reports, though, it seemed as though these stories of Mormons being miraculously spared from death were a new symptom of chosen people syndrome. You know, everybody overslept or miraculously got stuck in traffic, or, you know, all these things happened and that's what saved them. And initially I was embarrassed and not just a little angry that people would fabricate and circulate this kind of fiction. It was difficult for me to really be objective about these stories, my training as a journalist and an academic notwithstanding. You know, eventually the truth came to light, and a few Mormon news services issued a disclaimer about these and other stories. But even so, some Mormons seemed really resistant to acknowledging the fact that Mormons have been killed in these events. Mormons weren't the only ones fabricating stories. There was one, I don't know if you saw the fabricated photo of the guy standing on the railing with the plane about to hit from behind, or the story about the guy who surfed down to ground zero from the 80th floor on a slab of concrete. You know, this is the kind of stuff that people are shopping around in an effort to try to explain the tragedy or have some glimmer of hope in what looked like a really hopeless situation. Let's see, I'm going to have to skip a little bit. Robert Kirby wrote a column in the Salt Lake Tribune that discussed some of this and took on some of the myths that were circulating in Mormonism about this. So he always has his pulse on what's going on in the Mormon community, and I can give you the reference for that if you'd like. I don't have time to read it. But regardless, these stories, whether they're true or not, undoubtedly serve to bolster some Mormons' faith in a time of crisis. And for this reason, they have value to the people who believed them and circulated them. And these stories bolster that Mormon self-image. If I believe that Mormons are chosen people and God will protect his chosen people from meeting a tragic end, I will create stories that reinforce those beliefs. I was intrigued to see how this played out on a personal level. A woman in my ward was on vacation at the time of the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. And she sent us a postcard that was read in Relief Society saying that she knew that their flight to Europe before this happened would be safe because there are missionaries on a plane with her. And the first Sunday she was home, she reiterated the story, saying she felt safer getting on a plane after the events of September 11th because there are missionaries on her flight home too. And her assumption seemed to be that God would afford extra protection to young men and women dedicating their time to missionary work, and anyone who was in close proximity to them would share that same divine protection. And sadly, there are so many counterexamples of missionaries being killed in the line of duty for this assumption to really hold up. But for this individual, it helped her get on a plane and come home. So that belief had meaning to her, regardless of what other people thought. And William A. Wilson, who does a lot of work in Mormon folklore, talks about the value of these stories and how central they are to LDS culture, that they aren't simply on the fringe, but these stories that we tell about ourselves and about others that bolster faith or help you get on a plane, either one, are really central to to Mormonism. And I think some of these faith-promoting myths serve kind of a dual purpose. On one hand, they bolster people's faith at a time when it might need some shoring up. On the other hand, it can expose fissures in the Mormon self-image and bring to the surface issues Mormons may be reluctant to confront. What if God doesn't intervene to protect the innocent from harm? What if God doesn't protect Mormons from harm as a body? What if Mormons aren't really chosen above all the rest of God's children? What if Mormon missionaries don't enjoy more God-given protection than the rest of us? What if the set of beliefs and the self-image I've created around being Mormon, what if these beliefs fail me in a crisis? These are the questions sometimes we may be reluctant to explore, let alone answer. I'm going to have to wrap up. But I do want to touch on one thing. I'm involved in a class where we use a lot of films as part of our training. And we watched the movie The Crying Game. And afterwards, we were asked to kind of, you know, keep in mind as we were watching the film, which character bothered us the most. And then we were going to do some work on that after the film was over. And by and large, the character that everybody seemed to like the least or had the most trouble with was Jude, the violent, bitchy hit woman. And most of the people said, you know, I'm really bothered by her. I really didn't like her. She was mean. She was nasty. She killed people. She didn't care about anybody but herself. And so what we got into afterwards in our discussion and working with a partner was that our reactions to her being violent on screen and what disturbed us about that was really more about ourselves and was really more about our own fears of violence, our own fears that we might lose control and become violent or angry. The circumstances might force us, in some cases, to act violently to defend ourselves or loved ones. And there was also the preconception that women aren't supposed to be violent or show anger or be hit people, things like that. And what came out of the discussion afterwards, as we were kind of piecing together our new understandings of what bothered us about this violent character, was that violence has a place in the world just as much as love or joy or hate or fear or death. It's just there for us. And we can't change that fact, whether, you know, I mean, sure nobody likes the fact that violence is a part of our existence, but how we relate to it is more important than trying to figure out how to get rid of it, because I don't know that we can. And also, and I said in the beginning that it's important for us, if we're to understand ourselves as human beings, to understand the part that violence plays. And I think that this also plays into, you know, we can't really understand what it is to be human without looking at violence. I'd also say that we can't really understand what it is to be religious without understanding violence, because violence has a place in religion as well. All of Christianity is built on the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And his unjust death is what saves us. And, you know, theologically there's more I could say about that. But basically, that act of violence is what cleanses us from sin. And, you know, we may not like the fact that violence exists. We can choose not to perpetuate violence ourselves. But we would also have to ask ourselves, especially in a religious context, where would we be without it? Because, you know, like the theorists have said, it does seem to be one of the defining elements in our culture and in our religion too. So that's all I need to say.
As Angela said, this is the first time I've done this, so we'll give it a try. In Still Circling the Wagons, Violence and Mormon Self-Image, Mary Ellen paints a provocative picture of Mormon self-image grounded in a persecution complex. While aspects of our arguments relate well to the Mormon Church, I believe similar arguments apply to any true believer religion in the world, especially now after 9/11. She begins her paper by pointing out that violence and religion have coexisted for a long time. A mere look at a newspaper shows that the roots of continuing battles around the world are often prompted by religious and cultural differences. Samuel Huntington, 1997's, or Samuel Huntington's book, 1997, The Clash of Civilizations, discusses the fading of the West and the emergence of a new order of civilizations, largely defined by religious and cultural ideals associated with six core regions or countries, namely the West, which includes the U.S., Western Europe, and other nations, Japan, the Orthodox countries, which refer to Russia and the surrounding regions, Islam, which is the Arab countries and Islamic countries, Sinic, which refers to China and the surrounding regions, and Hindu, which refers to India and the surrounding regions. Some of the most volatile regions in the world are those in which two or more of these civilizations intersect, sometimes within one nation. Take the Philippines, India, and Israel as examples. Often the battle is intensified when not only are there different religious groups attempting to coexist, but also when one or more of the groups consists of fundamentalists who would rather die for their beliefs than change or adapt their point of view. Mary Ellen's point that violence has existed in Mormonism is also true. As she so clearly points out, we've been victims of violent actions, largely for religious reasons. Persecution, at least in history, persecutions of Mormons in the East and Midwest, and the murder of Joseph and Hiram Smith were a couple of the examples. Stories of violence are also retold, believing Churchill's line that a nation that forgets its past is doomed to repeat it. The church, with its articulated curriculum and all of its church manuals, reviews these persecutions and does tend to downplay members' parts in fostering this hatred, such as Mormons' tendency to vote in blocks and patronize their own businesses. Mary Ellen notes that the extent to which this mentality is still with us today has created a type of persecution complex in which Mormons perceive everyone is against them. Others feel that this type of persecution constitutes the refiner's fire, worthy of the trials the chosen people must endure. I can refer to my own missionary service, and you hear these kinds of stories from other missionaries, but those of us that have been on missions have had heated discussions with Protestant ministers and Jehovah's Witnesses. This was in Toronto where I was. Hearing comments that Mormonism is of the devil. And persecution on college campuses may be more subtle. I'm at a Southern California campus, and you do hear the occasional snide comment from a colleague who knows I'm a Mormon. Or sometimes it's more overt persecution, not being asked to present a paper or join a grant writing group because of acknowledged differences of belief. But Mary Ellen is correct in saying that life endangerment is no longer really a threat. In my opinion, what came out of 9/11 was something much more serious than a few Mormon folk tales or urban legends about miraculous protections of Mormons in the building. What was revealed was that violence does exist, and it's often rooted in religion and culture. Many astounded Americans near Ground Zero were interviewed after the disaster, and they wondered why anyone would do something like this to them. In the following weeks, Americans across the country that hadn't set foot in a church, mosque, or temple for months or years went back, trying to make sense of Muslim, Jewish, Christian teachings, which raged against such senseless killing of innocent people. If anything, Mormon persecution in the past and present can be appreciated by Mormons and others in the world now more than ever. People now realize that someone's religion is reason enough for some people to kill. Adherence to organized religion today probably fall into two main categories, and this is probably overgeneralizing, but those who believe the premises are true and therefore must participate, and those who participate hoping that the premises are true. In the church, we speak of those who have a testimony and those who have faith on others' testimonies. Both are welcome in the fold. Either way, all who participate believe that the religion works in some way, for some reason. Otherwise, they might leave or might hang out in Sunstone for a while and then leave. Mormons, like any other devout Christian, Jew, or Muslim, believe in a higher power that might protect the innocent from harm, that might favor one group over another at certain times of history. Mary Ellen's title about self-image should not be forgotten. However, Mormon self-image is based on something more substantial than persecution and paranoia. Since primary, we have learned that we are important because we are children of God. This is grounded in Christian theology. Jesus knew he was the Son of God and that he was fulfilling Scripture. He confidently acknowledged the need to suffer pain in order to fulfill his lifelong mission and called others to follow him. Whether this is true or not, Latter-day Saints must hope that it is true in order to maintain theological integrity. Mary Ellen's apt critique of the Santa Claus version of Mormonism, where members get special rewards and attention simply because they are members, must be discarded. Mormons experience pain, illness, abuse, just like anyone else, but it is in the hope of a preferred world or a celestial kingdom that they might have the strength to ameliorate these problems. Mary Ellen states that it's time that Mormons come out of their mental bunkers. If anything, the September 11th events have pointed to the need for such bunkers and protections. There are truly people who do not like us and would like to harm us. As well as the need for others in even deeper mental bunkers, those closed off from any kind of morals or religious values, to step forward and locate those values that they believe in, be they Muslim, Christian, or Jew. The distressful, alienated Mormon identity which Mary Ellen refers to is actually quite familiar. We've seen it before in the Jews. Both groups view themselves as a chosen people, and she humorously points to the fact that Mormons may be wired a little differently. I'm sure that this criticism could be leveled against the Jews around the world as well. And for that matter, true believers of any religion could be viewed as such. Mormon persecutions can also be compared to Jewish persecutions. Are there similarities between Bogg's extermination order and Hitler's final solution? Can Mormons who retell their pioneer persecutions be compared to Jews who recall stories of their murdered relatives in the death camps? And should the tales of violence be retold in every Sunday school, Relief Society, and priesthood meeting lesson? Members of Judaism would probably say yes. After all, the Seder meal commemorates the trials and hardships of their people in Egypt. So how does all this relate to Mary Ellen's thesis? Mormons who have faith in their religion might always suffer some persecution, less in the United States where human rights are protected, but more in many other nations. This is the nature of having a spiritual point of view of being special in the world and counted by God. However, history seems to be telling us that prudence, love, understanding will go a long way in preserving one's ability to worship according to one's conscience in a multicultural, multi-religious world in which every other group who believes that they are special too. As long as these cultures regenerate and renew themselves, they'll also continue to tell themselves faith-promoting stories mixed among the rumors. They will suffer persecution for their differences, be it wearing Muslim burqas or Mormon wedding garments or Jewish yarmulkes. They will remember their sufferings, and they will underplay their role in prompting these persecutions because that is what the ego does for self-protection. What happens from here is anyone's guess. If Samuel Huntington is correct, it will be a world of coexisting cultures pursuing their own worldview, scuffling at each other's borders, but having the good sense to negotiate and communicate before they all kill each other. I believe that Mormons are just one part of the larger Christian group who will be circling the wagons and vying for that opportunity.
I want to thank our speaker and our respondent and ask them if they wouldn't mind coming up, both of you, and then we have about 15 minutes before the end of the session, so if anybody has any questions, you're welcome to ask. Well, please identify who the question is for.
In case anyone thought I had all the answers regarding violence, I don't. Not even in the stuff I didn't read.
Mary Ellen? Are you aware of the stories that circled the world internet in terms of the Jews that were not in the World Trade Center?
I heard on
the day in the Arab world, the most dominant story told is that this wasn't an Arab conspiracy; it was a Jewish conspiracy, as evidenced by all of the Jews that were not in the World Trade Center who worked there normally that day. And I have heard high-level government people repeat over and over again that therefore this was done by. This is a Mossad, a Jewish conspiracy, that they hired these guys to do it because all the Jews were warned and were not there. Are you?
I heard a little bit about that after I prepared my remarks, but I'm probably not as well connected on Jewish internet discussion lists as I am on Mormon ones. So, yeah, I mean, I really don't think the impulse to tell stories or to find, you know, a scapegoat, or to find some way to explain the inexplicable, that's not unique to Mormonism. So it doesn't surprise me that there are other groups, you know, telling the same kinds of stories of miraculous sparing and, you know, who might have been at fault.
But this comes from the other side, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Assign blame rather than protection.
Yeah.
I wonder if you've thought at all about the racism and classism that existed in the initial reports that no Mormons were killed in the World Trade Center. They were relying on reports from Manhattan stake representatives, but the person who was killed on the ground at the Trade Center was a new member who was Hispanic from the outer boroughs, and he was a restaurant worker in Windows on the World. And I think that the fact that they didn't even think that someone would be in that situation who was a Mormon, I mean, just didn't hurt them at all, that anybody would be in the World Trade Center from that perspective.
Yeah, the question, I'll repeat that sort of for the take, pointing out the racism and classism that existed in the supposition that no Mormons were killed in the World Trade Center attack. I guess the assumption was that if you were Mormon, you'd be working in the World Trade Center in a more business capacity, and it didn't account for the one LDS person on the ground who was killed, who was a food service worker at Windows on the World. So, yeah, there's an inequity there, again, that people might not have initially accounted for, you know, another type of worker in the building, a service worker rather than a business person.
See if I can do this quickly. I think it's interesting how religions do claim protection. I thought coming out of all this was interesting. The two women who were arrested for proselytizing in Afghanistan, when they were released, finally claimed that it was through God's intervention that they were released, which, if you follow that to a logical conclusion, means that God crashed the planes into the World Trade Center in order to set up the conditions that would release them from Afghanistan. So how much do you think people do that to get religious protection without really thinking of the consequences of what it really entails, it would mean?
Well, I think it is also part of our human capacity to maybe stretch to accommodate things that are not entirely logical, like you said.
Do you think it happens in Mormons a lot?
Yeah, I think, the tendency that I saw was, and especially this came up in another email discussion list that I was on, where a woman was describing a conversation at work, and her Mormon co-workers were really trying to convince someone that no Mormons were killed, and that was, I'm trying to think of how she put it, but basically she, you know, tried to disabuse them of that notion and said actually there were people killed in the planes, people killed on the ground, and these folks were really resistant to even hearing that. And, you know, she was saying, you know, they're telling her, well, you shouldn't tell this non-Mormon person we're trying to convince, stuff like that. And she says, what, like facts? And, you know, the non-Mormon person who was there, you know, not really being swayed by the arguments, was saying, I think you understand that the way that they're communicating is also indicating that, you know, Mormons are special. And, you know, that they didn't feel that their propaganda was doing that necessarily, but that's how the recipient heard it.
Well, I'm wondering if people keep telling these stories, and we hear them in testimony meeting every month too, where there's a mix of stories that you think might be true, and others that, you know, somebody's fooling themselves to think that, you know, that they were saved or something. So there must be some level at which people stop believing, that there's enough believable.
This awful thing happened as a way to pave the way to more glorious things later on. And I wonder, you know, it just makes me wonder if an all-powerful, omniscient God couldn't have a plan B that didn't involve the war to open the country, didn't involve a decapitation to get the plates. You know, that's one of the things where my wrestling comes in. It's like, did A have to happen the way A happened in order for B to be affected?
A couple of observations. Number one, I assume you're aware that these kinds of stories that you're recounting in Mormonism occur in every religious community, where there's a personal God and the idea that God actually operates in history. And they will continue as long as that belief is there. They are part of their logical deduction from that good that comes to me doesn't. Is God operating on my behalf, and a tacit denial that bad is God's operating against me. So God helped me win the ball game, but God's not to blame for me losing. What you're recounting is the logical extension of that story.
Yeah.
That God helped me. More cogently, I think in your analysis of violence, if you might want to draw a distinction, a very sharp distinction between persecution and discrimination. I know of no cases since World War I of any Mormon in this country being persecuted. No cases. Discriminated, yes, but evangelical Christians are discriminated against, Jehovah's Witnesses are discriminated against. No persecution. That's not true in other countries, of course, but in this country it might be good to draw that kind of distinction. And also to draw a distinction between the storytellings and myths and reality. The storytellings of persecution in the 19th century is one thing, but violence in the Mormon community is a much broader thing. The Morrisite incident, the Mountain Meadows incident, Donner Pass, there's a whole set of incidences in which Mormons were the participants in causing the violence. And also in analyzing violence, you must be careful not to blame the victim for the violence. There is no justification for persecution. It's the persecutor's problem, not the person. I don't cause violence by being different. The other person...
You might incite violence to be different.
Yeah, but yeah. I'm not blaming them.
Yeah.
The last 4 or 5 months I've been studying on a full-time basis the impact of murder on real estate values in Utah. I I study disasters. I testify as an expert witness in court as it relates to stigma damages. Literally, we've got jobs studying high-rise office buildings at Ground Zero in New York. We did it in 93. We literally wrongful death case against O.J. Simpson, Heaven's Gate Mansion, JonBenet Ramsey, on and on and on. And what I find particularly helpful and insightful is that your conclusions, in essence, corroborate my conclusions, which are based on empirical data as it relates more on a psychographic level, and that is that in Utah, people will not discount will be affected by the impact of murder in an office building or a restaurant or an apartment. And the data sets out that there is no discount. There is that the people don't really seem to be impacted by it on an ongoing basis. And from what you're telling me is that based on the history that we have, that we in essence kind of have a put your shoulder to the wheel kind of attitude. You know, we'll get through this, and it's not going to have an ongoing impact. And I find it very, very enlightening in helping explain something that I can kind of conclude it to on a completely different level. So thank you very much.
You say that differs in other states from
Utah? It can be very geographic specific. For instance, in Hawaii, remember the Xerox shooting a couple years ago? 7 people were murdered in Honolulu by a disgruntled employee in Hawaii because of basically the Asian and the concept of feng shui. Murder has a significant effect on that issue. You'll find that properties are not discounted being next to a hazardous waste dump, but if they're next to a cemetery, it's 15% automatically. And so in Honolulu, where this occurred, there is a significant damage on this industrial building as it relates to murder. But again, taking it down, I've studied dozens of these in Utah alone, and there's this practical element, that this way of thinking that, you know, well, the building's still there was just a hole in the wall, and, you know, who cares?
It's,
you know,
a good deal, right? It's a great price. Good neighborhood otherwise, yeah.
I'm sorry, this isn't getting on tape. This is interesting. I find what you say very interesting. Do you think that, at least in the little infinitesimal amount of experience I've had with this data, makes me think that the more superstitious people are, that have that kind of a mindset, that superstitious kind of a mindset, would be more affected by somebody having been murdered? We're inured to it, maybe not just as Mormons, but certainly as Western culture, civilization have been immersed in violence, you know, forever. I think we are more inured to that, and it doesn't bother us. But the superstitions, like those people from the Pacific, the Mediterranean, not Mediterranean, not South, well, it's not the islands, but the Western Indies, West Indies. Those people have a very superstitious way of interpreting things.
You need to be careful that you use superstition, because there's a corollary there between that and what we'll term the religion. And we're as superstitious as the Japanese when it comes to the number 13 and their number 4. Number 4 means death. You've got 444, absolute certain death. You're 13, you go to a hotel, it's got 13 floors, but it's the 14th floor. It's specific, but I understand what you're saying, based in terms of our religious background, where we don't look at things like that in terms of affecting us. I mean, the concept of ghosts and things like that, well, you know, it's a spirit, and reach out and shake the hand, and that's a good spirit if you can't feel anything, or, you know, whatever it is.
There's a lot of richness there. Yeah.
Mary Ellen, have you, or do you know of any studies done on the actual, the personal response of LDS to actual violence? As a child, I was acculturated to be a victim. I wasn't a victim, but the church and my family and my heritage said, well, you're not allowed to protect yourself or fight back. And so consequently, the good little Mormon boys, we tended to be more picked on because it was known that we would not defend ourselves because we were taught that we couldn't. and certainly shouldn't defend herself in a violent situation. Has anybody ever addressed that?
I'm not aware of any. That doesn't mean that no studies exist that address that correlation between, I guess, what the impact of being LDS is on violent interpersonal interactions, and whether LDS people, I guess, shun violence or are picked on more. I don't know. I'll have to do some more digging into that. I think it would be interesting to see, you know, if that can be assessed in perhaps a more qualitative manner.
Oh, well, I was actually commenting on something earlier that I think part of when we're talking about the land values and so on, we have to remember that we also have this belief that we can come in and dedicate a space and kind of erase, in a sense, the negative aspects of some of that. And I think that may be part of that consideration. It's our belief that I just come. So what if that's happened? I come in, I have the vision dedicated or whoever I may have in authority, and then that eradicates that whole idea of the negative vibration.
Yeah, we can undo it.
Yeah, we have to acknowledge our own rituals.
But the Asian community has that as well in their own way. You know, they'll bring in their masters and do whatever they do to do exactly what you're saying, but that's an interesting one.
Is there a question?
Yeah. I guess my question, Mary Ellen, is that everybody's reality gets created through storytelling. And the retelling of stories is where you get all your meaning. And in our culture, we want to continue to perpetuate very much what you presented today. Do you find, as you kind of carry these ideas, that there's ever going to be room in our community to tell these stories differently? I mean, for me, where my concern is that I see even general authorities are trying to talk about our violence or about what adversity is in a different way. But as a culture, we want to continue to tell these stories in a way that if you find there's ever going to be a room, or do you see where there will be pockets for when we can tell our stories in a way that kind of takes on about what is being a chosen people, or what is it about being persecuted, or what is our role in all that? And I just wondered, as you're carrying around these ideas, are you finding there's room in church meetings or in other communities to try and tell our stories in different ways?
Yeah, the question speaks to the fact that we create our reality through storytelling, and is there a possibility that we might, as Mormons, tell some of our own stories of trauma differently? I think it's possible. I also know that my own interest in the subject of violence was piqued by a seminar that I took in graduate school on gender violence and religion. And I had to step out of my own, you know, Mormon culture to really take a look, to even be aware of the impact of violence and to see where religion played into it, to see where gender played into violence, to see where, you know, race, class, ethnicity all comes into that. I think if we maybe venture outside a little bit more, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done in violence, in the field of religious studies, in theological studies. So I think we might need to, in some small way, step out of our own cultural training where violence is concerned in order to say, okay, there are other perspectives. We could tell, you know, the story of Hans Mill maybe in a different way, or, you know, the violence that touched, you know, Mormon ancestors as they came across the plains. I don't think that's impossible to do, but I think within the culture what gets reinforced is this, you know, poor me, I got picked on and kicked out of my house in Missouri and, you know, had to cross the plains in bare feet. And I think we kind of magnify that aspect of the story rather than having a focus on basic human resilience in adverse conditions. And I think if we step out and like this other gentleman said, you know, these stories aren't unique to Mormonism, you know, they're true in other religions too, they're told the same way in other religions too, that I do think maybe being exposed to something other than Mormonism would contribute to being able to tell those stories in a different way, or to see these events from a different perspective. You know, what must it have been like to be, you know, a shopkeeper in Missouri and have thousands of Mormons move into your neighborhood and buy from their own shopkeeper? You know, how would that feel? And, you know, I don't know that we get that sense as long as we're in this little tiny Mormon box and way of viewing our world. So I certainly think it's possible, but I do think we have to expand our vision in order to tell these stories a little differently.
You focused mostly on psychological and group dynamics aspects of that for your presentation, but there is a scriptural driving impetus behind all of this that may make it difficult for us ever to change our story, at least in the foreseeable future. The scriptures keep telling us that the faithful will be persecuted, and that's a theme that is repeated throughout the scriptures. And so that is our signpost of being faithful in many ways. And right now, frankly, Mormons are a relatively prosperous people in the Intermountain West. And there's just not any persecution to deal with. So we have to magnify minor incidents, and we have to pull from the past. Otherwise, we have no indication that we are indeed faithful. And I think there are many religions that are in exactly the same situation. They are desperately searching for a way to show that they are indeed being persecuted enough that therefore they're the faithful. So until that changes, I don't think we have a chance to change our story.
I want to thank everyone in your comments and our speakers again, and thanks for coming to the session.